Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Don Neely view system, Diogo. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
We're recording the podcast over the next few weeks at Sixes Cricket Club. If you haven't heard about Sixes, Sixes Cricket Club is the new cricket-themed social entertainment venue with a restaurant, bar and cricket nets. Sixes have clubhouses in Fulham, Fitzrovia and a third venue opening up in Manchester on August 29th. The Wisden team have come here before and had a thoroughly enjoyable afternoon out, so I couldn't recommend it any higher. Anyway, on with the show. I'm Yaz Rahn, and today we've got a slightly different panel to usual. Ben Gardner's off hosting duties. We've got friend of the show, CricViz analyst Ben Jones with us, as well as tailender Felix White, who has a new book out later this week. It's Always Summer Somewhere. We'll be talking about that later in the show. I've watched very little cricket in my week off, so you guys are going to have to do even more of the heavy lifting than usual. We'll start with the big news of the week. Ben Stokes is taking an indefinite break from the game with immediate effect. Managing Director of England Men's Cricket, Ashley Giles, said Ben has showed tremendous courage to open up about his feelings and well-being. Our primary focus has always been and will continue to be the mental health and welfare of all of our people. The demands on our athletes to prepare and play elite sport are relentless in a typical environment, but the ongoing pandemic has acutely compounded this. Spending significant amounts of time away from family with minimal freedoms is extremely challenging. The cumulative effect of operating almost continuously in these environments over the last 16 months has had a major impact on everyone's well-being. Ben will be given as long as he needs, and we look forward to seeing him play cricket for England in the future. Ben, Giles alluded to the challenges of the last 16 months in that statement, but with a schedule that awaits England's all format players and the schedules they've had for the last 16 months, this is almost inevitable.
Yeah, well, because it was interesting, because this news broke just after the pod. We recorded the pod last week, and on that show we discussed the fact that the IPL had been scheduled for 5 or 6 days after the England test finish, and then to finish 2 days before the T20 World Cup starts. Like, nothing gets cancelled these days. Everything gets postponed, pushed down the line. And, you know, we know these environments are unsustainable, but basically they've been like, they'll, in a way, they'll sort of have all the noises about, you know, players can say when they're feeling not, you know, when they're not feeling great, and they can you know, that be as understanding as possible, but the actual things that could properly make a difference to, you know, how long these players are going to be able to play for and that sort of thing is just playing less cricket, and that's not what's happening or what's going to happen. So yeah, it was inevitable, but it is good that Stokes has been able to feel that he can say this and can drop out on the eve of a big series. That is a step forward, I suppose, but it's the causes of it are, I don't think, going to get fixed anytime soon, I think.
Mm. In the statement, Giles said, our primary focus has always been and will continue to be the mental health and welfare of all our people. And I kind of agree with you. If that really was the case, you wouldn't schedule quite as much cricket as it has been. I remember particularly that South Africa series last year, kind of squeezing off the IPL before a really long tour to Asia. Kind of felt like slightly unnecessary. Felix, you're obviously close to one member of the England squad. Do you think the public have that accurate an understanding of just how hard it is living in bubbles, team environments, well, etc. in time of COVID?
It's an interesting point, and I actually think maybe they do. I think the response that I've seen everywhere has been like 100% forgiving of the situation, and I think that would be very different, for example, from what happened with Michael Yardy even, or Truscoffy even a few years ago. So I think the public generally do. I haven't heard one voice saying things you would have done a few years ago, like he's bottled it or whatever, all that kind of stuff. So I did possibly do. I don't know if that's how. I haven't actually read the statement of what he said. Is it a family thing, or he wants to be at home, or?
I think it was unspecific. I think it said to prioritise his mental well-being, but and they all spoke of him wanting to rest his left finger, which I think is as recovered as it would like after being broken. And I guess those two things can feed into each other. I guess if you are feeling a bit like if you're mentally not 100% for whatever reason, and you're also then not fully confident in your body's ability, then that's two things that are going to affect, like those two things can feed into each other, I guess.
Yeah, I thought that was quite an interesting angle to it all, because you don't want to speculate too much on what's going on behind the scenes. But I saw a few people, as Felix said, very few people were critical of Stokes' decision. But I saw a few people maybe questioning the fact that they'd almost thrown in the idea of his finger being injured as well, to like just double things down a little bit, to be like, well, he's not feeling great and he's a little bit injured. But I think you're right, is that actually for a professional athlete, your mental health is linked intrinsically to your body and to how you can perform and do your job. And we all know what it's like in any walk of life professionally. If you're not at your peak doing your job, then that creates knock-on effects. And yeah, they are clearly linked. So getting Stokes back physically well is obviously tied to getting him back mentally ready to go and play cricket whenever, for whoever, wherever in the world. And whether that's while the pandemic's ongoing and we're still living in bubbles, or whether it's after that, maybe he won't feel that he's comfortable coming back into that environment until things have changed. And personally, I can understand that completely. I've not had to do any bubbling, and I know people who have speak about it very differently to those who are looking from the outside. Yeah. And whilst there is clearly that public affection for Stokes and kind of trust that he's not bottling it, and there's an understanding about mental health that I think we've all gained and improved upon in the last few years, it's quite hard to... I think it's quite a nice reflection of where English cricket is, that we're okay to say, yeah, our best player, just go and take your time. Go and take that time away. And sometimes it takes these big events for us to realise how far we've come in terms of the conversation. We can all, you know, hypothetically witter on about, well, you know, we're all much more understanding. But like, yeah, Ben Stokes decided he doesn't want to play for England for a summer. And everyone's gone, yeah, that's all right. That's fine. You do that.
And I know you guys talked about it on last week's show about the possibility of players pulling out of the Ashes. But I was speaking to someone last week who was in a bubble, and it really... it's really difficult, but I don't think I really understood how difficult it is now that society is actually opening up. Last summer, when no one could do anything, I think it was slightly less taxing in a way than it is now, when you come out and, you know, you come out for a couple of weeks and everyone's kind of gone back to their normal lives. Being stuck there, not being able to see your family for such a long time is just really, really difficult.
I think we all feel a bit like that as well. It's like, it's a different challenge, not to do with cricket, but like when it was, you know, we're all in this together and everyone's doing the same thing all over the world. It's one thing, and it's a different challenge when you're seeing different people in different situations acting differently. So yeah, hopefully gets back to full fitness and full mental well-being as soon as possible from a cricket point of view. But also I'm glad that he feels able to take that decision and take as long as he needs.
I think that's the point that Ben's made there. I've had it just completely non-cricket related, where now we've come out of lockdown, even if I've gone to see friends or been playing like really low level club cricket, when I'm walking around the corner, I think, I don't think I want to do this, actually. Like, I don't want to be here. And there's something in your body, like, from the sort of traumatised year and a half we've had, that's telling you that. When I've turned up and said it to people, everyone's like, I'm exactly the same. And so if you put on top of that, playing for England in test matches, I think the general consensus will be that everyone completely understands.
100%. Ben, from a cricketing point of view, the test series does start this week. Ben Stokes' absence is enormous for the series. How do you think England will go about trying to replace Stokes in the 11?
Well, there is just one thing on that I think is linked to the discussion of how the ECB have handled that, and just overall how they look after their players, I suppose, which is that they deserve credit for how they've handled the Stokes situation. But in an ideal world, there'd be no pandemic. But in a slightly more ideal world, it would be just Moeen Ali coming in and playing number seven as the world class rounder that he is. And I think if you just, and the fact that, you know, England are depleted to this extent where, you know, Wokes and Stokes are both out, Moeen Ali is fit, playing well in the 100, but is not in that squad, I think that speaks quite a lot of and maybe by rights right now he shouldn't be in that squad, but it speaks a lot for how the ECB and England have handled him over that time. I mean, if you look at the rest and rotation policy, which was noble, which was their sort of way to you know, help prevent some of these issues, the one player who they asked to sort of forego their period of agreed rest was Moeen Ali. And this was even after he had, as he arrived in Sri Lanka, tested positive for COVID-19, had to be ill in a hotel room, away from his family and everyone else for, you know, 2 weeks, and then to return. So I think that's a real shame as well, that we've now got to this stage where it's just hard to see when Moeen's going to be playing to again. But from
answered my question.
From the squad they've selected, what I think they'll do, I think it's a bit different to the New Zealand series when they just didn't have any all-rounders at all. So that's why they had to have four bowlers and no Leach. I think, and I hope, they'll go with Sam Curran at seven and then four bowlers, and then I guess your keeper at six, Butler, and probably Lawrence at number five if Pope is likely to be unfit, or even if there's a bit of a doubt there, they're close enough that I think that would be enough to edge Lawrence ahead, I guess. Is that the way you go, Ben?
Yeah, I think so. I've tried to like come up with different, you know, different alternatives and try and be a bit clever about it, but I think that's pretty much the only option, is Curran at seven, Butler at six, and then four bowlers. It probably impresses Bonding on the importance of picking Ollie Robinson as a number eight who can really bat, because I think if Chris Wokes was fit and available, he'd slot in perfect. But obviously the Robinson debacle over the last few months, I think the ECB have just about dealt with it well enough that they can pick Robinson straight out the gate. They don't need to ease him back in. I think they can just pick him in the first test, and that's important. And then from there, I think we saw against New Zealand the issues with not picking a spinner. Personally, I think that England should be able to do it a bit more often given English conditions, and it shouldn't be a taboo idea not picking a specialist spinner at home. But I think given the current situation and given the batting fragility, I think you need to have as many different points to your attack as possible. So I think Leach drops in, and then it's a case of resting and rotating, to use the phrase, the rest of the seamers. And I think ideally you want Mark Wood probably playing just to give something different to the attack. I'm not Wood's biggest advocate as a Red Bull bowler at home, but if you're going to have Robinson and Curran and Anderson, you probably don't need a fourth Overton-style bowler. You might need something, just a point of difference, to go alongside Leach, the spinner.
I think that there is a stage as well, because England will be tempted, I think, to go down there, because especially Stokes is more of a loss on the batting side than on the bowling side.
So without doubt, yeah.
We'll be tempted to strengthen the batting department and then rely on that route, Lawrence, for that spinner role. But I think it's time that Jack Leach deserves some reward, basically, for all the good work he's done in Test cricket. I mean, he is a very good Test match bowler who's had a very good start to his Test career. The last time he played a home Test, he bowled England to an Ashes levelling victory, and that was now nearly 2 years ago. It's crazy to think that that's... I mean, there's been...
his last Test match.
Yeah. Last Test match in England.
Home Test match was, that Oval Test match against the Aussies.
Wow.
2019.
So I was going to ask, what's happened with Jack? Is he the frontline spinner still in terms of... Everyone's thinking.
I think last summer it was a case of them investing in Bess and wanting to make him as good a version of the cricketer that he is as possible. So having him bat at eight, helping balance out the side, recognising that was going to be an issue going forward, particularly with rotating and stuff. But I don't think anyone in their right mind thinks that Jack Leach isn't a better bowler than Bess. He's so clearly the superior option. Whether Parkinson might even be a better option is a different conversation.
I think like last summer when Bess did okay, and then Stokes left to go to New Zealand one test into the Pakistan series. And I think to balance the side out, it was quite hard to take Bess out because of his batting. I just feel with Leach, he just doesn't get enough credit for what he does really well. So bowling Australia out on the last day of an Ashes test match. No, not many people do that.
Decent.
Had a really good winter in India, obviously. But also, even when he took a six for against Surrey in the county championship a few weeks ago, it's like...
I was going to say, internet that was a masterclass,
goes crazy.
Wasn't it? Yeah.
Everyone goes crazy when Ashwin does it the next day, but Leach did even better the day before.
Yeah,
there is probably a technical argument that Leach is a better bowler in helpful conditions. And that's... I don't think... That's not to... You know, to criticise him, he's a fantastic bowler in helpful conditions because he's so methodical and he's so accurate and he just doesn't bowl any bad balls. But he doesn't do a tremendous amount through the air. He does most of his work off the pitch. And that was, I think, why they were so keen on Bess, was because, particularly with a view to Australia, that actually you need to do things through the air. You need a bit of drift, a bit of dip. And Leach is a bit more, he'll do you off the pitch. I think they'll be encouraged by the fact that the weather's been so outrageously hot that actually English pitches, they've talked about wanting to prepare for the Ashes and create these hard batting-friendly tracks. That might actually suit Leach a bit better, because if it's going to break up, it's going to spin a little bit more. There's a bit more of an opportunity for him to come to the party. But I mean, I just think that England, given the situation they're in and the fact that they're going to be without Wokes, they're going to be without Archer, they're going to be without Stone, their group of seamers is depleted. So you need to be relying on a spinner to play throughout. So I think going in with the New Zealand balance of four seamers and Root being the spinner, I think that would be, you know, going up a dark alley.
I think this is also an Indian team that's not, in a way, that's got the stereotypical strengths of an Indian batting lineup, where actually I think a lot of them are better against pace than against spin. And Leach had, he almost had the wood over Pujara in that series. I think he got him out more than any other spinner has in the series.
I think so. I think he averages like 11 against him.
Yeah, and if you, and you know,
get him
if,
in, yeah, just for that.
Well, but genuinely, I mean, if you can get
Xavier Doherty style,
if you can get Pujara early, that is a huge inroad into that batting, because they bat around him to more than any other team bats around one batter in world cricket, I think, really. So yeah, I think that's another reason why a specialist spinner and probably Leach is a must, I think.
All the right-handers as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Can I just quickly, just like listening to you guys talk, it's made me realise, I think this is the summer that I've thought as little about the test series coming up as any summer in English cricket. Just even hearing you guys talk about it, I've realised that I don't even know what the England team is, and it feels like I haven't even heard a conversation about what this test team is going to be next week up in the run into this. Has that struck any of you? Like there's,
I think it was Lawrence Booth tweeted about it, saying that this feels like a test series that snuck up on us more than any other. I think that's partly, most obviously, to do with the 100, because that's clearly a big event that is happening that is distracting everyone. Sure. But I think it's also due to this, there was that false start to the summer with the test series against New Zealand, where it was like, well, it's not the full strength team.
It's
like, well, Stokes isn't there, Butler's not there, Moeen's not there, Wokes. So it's like, it felt a bit like we're kind of getting through that. And then it was the World Test Championship, and it's like,
yeah, right,
into the 100. So I think it's definitely something I've felt. I mean, from a professional point of view, I've had to do quite a lot of work over the weekend that I probably should have done about 10 days ago, because it's suddenly been like, oh, Christ, yeah, that's next week, which is not something you normally think about. Like,
I think
for a test of the
summer. In a normal test summer, there's more momentum. I mean, the New Zealand series was literally 2 months ago. There's normally not that kind of gap between test series. The World Test Championship was ages ago as well. There's been one or two rounds of the county championship, and I think one way in which a test series gets hype is when someone gets runs in the county championship, and you're like, oh, Hamid's got runs, whatever,
and you
end up talking about it a little bit more.
Yeah, and that was what the warm-up game did
exactly.
But that shows you that was one game, and that's given it the kick that it needed.
Exactly.
I think it will be interesting to see how that spills onto the pitch, because if you take what happened in the winter, you had a feeling at the end of that series that this was going to be, there's been quite a lot of ill feeling in this series, actually, and it wasn't going to be like the charitable in any sense at all. And I think if we hadn't had the stuff that's happened in the interim, there would have been a lot of hype and anticipation about the matchups between these players. And so it's going to be interesting to see if that's carried through. Do you know what I mean? Whether they pick that back up again.
It's also, I think, partly because maybe it's those key markers that we look for in terms of kickstarting the hype for a series, but like, India have been here for ages. They've been watching Wimbledon, been at the Euros, like they've been doing the full like old style test tour where they've been away from home for a long time. That thing of like seeing like Virat Kohli has landed in England, that was ages ago. That's not a thing anymore. I think all those little cues, but I think you're right, that there was that sense in the winter of like, these two sides, it's not that they really hate each other or anything. I don't think there's that kind of level of animosity, but like, that was a grubby series that felt a bit rough. I loved it. It was great. Really entertaining, but like, it felt like the kind of thing where it's like, well, we'll get you back to England if we're going to do you. And actually it was like, well, suddenly we're like, oh yeah, it's that, is it? We're remembering the narratives in a way that normally we spend 2 months building up to them.
And I think the other interesting point is that everyone, when it got announced we're going to do back-to-back series, we were all saying we're going to be so bored of it by the time they come to England. But I don't think that's going to be the case.
Yeah, maybe
at all. I don't think there is going to be any element of like, we had those back-to-back Ashes and it was just done by the second return tour.
I think this is moving on to the next bit, but I think what could kind of bring back that ill feeling is that I think England could really take a pasting in this series.
Right. Yeah.
I think this could be a bit of a watershed moment for English Test cricket, because India are in really good shape. They've not played a lot of cricket, but like, they're a really good side, and they're basically the same side that came in 2018 and got no luck for an entire summer. And England were quite good then. England have got a lot worse, and India have probably got a bit better. And you can't see Sam Curran having the series that he had. You can't see conditions being quite the same as they had. In 2018, you had that extreme seam movement. It was like the most ever recorded in England. We're not going to have that again, because that was a bit of a freak. We're going to see the ball swing probably. This batch of Duke seem to be swinging a bit more than seaming. So the conditions are going to be a bit different. But I think let's not beat about the bush. India are really good and England are not very good. England can't really bat, and India have a lot of very, very good bowlers. Just because Jadeja and Ashwin are bowling at Trent Bridge rather than in Chennai, they're still going to be a real handful. And I think if I was England, the Stokes dropping out as tipped it for me. I thought England would have won 3-2, maybe 2-1 with a couple of draws or whatever, if Stokes had played. But he's the guy that balances the side, and he's their best batsman. You take that out, I think England are in a really worrying place. Not to like be overly emotional about it, but I just mean like from a practical point of view, you look at it and you're like, I can't see how they compete.
Yeah, the only thing I'd say to that is, obviously the Indian batting lineup is full of massive names, but there are a lot of guys in there who haven't actually got that many runs in the last 2 years. You know, kind of Pant, Sharma aside, really, no one's really been consistent. And then, you know, we'll see what the pitch is like. But if it does swing quite a lot, you'd back Robinson, Broad, Anderson, Wood, Overton to make life quite difficult for them. So I think it could be a really low-scoring series.
But then what about Shami, Siraj, Bumrah against, you know, a bunch of English batsmen who are out of nick and haven't made a run for ages?
I think Woke's missing the first two tests is huge. Yeah. With Stokes not there, I think he could be the kind of guy who could possibly make up for Stokes' absence.
Especially the Lord's test, where he averages something like 60 with a bat and under 20 with a ball.
The psychological hold. Yeah. We talk about Curran having that from 2018, but like, yeah, that Wokes game.
Yeah.
Just getting back there. They should make him be fit for that. Just, you know, weekend at Bernie's style. Just get him out there.
I think a weird amount depends on Rory Burns from an English point of view for this series, in that like, Root obviously is the one that you look at that line and think like, he's the one that's got to have a huge series. But his home record in basically last, since he took the captaincy, or just the summer after the captaincy, is just not, it's not elite. Basically, he averaged about 30, whereas his away averaged about 50 in that time. So that's the big drop off. Whereas Burns is, so he's had a bit of an up and down time, but he looks now kind of in about as good a form as he's, or at least before the big break, had looked his form as good as it kind of ever been. And he's always been that player who kind of gets 80s pretty consistently, like, but doesn't like. Yeah, even for Surrey, he wasn't like getting hundreds all the time. He was like getting 1,000 runs a season, averaging about 40, but doing that by like consistently getting pitches. Whereas this series, I think he needs to, if he can dominate, and he has the skill to, and he's like, he's got the form to, if he can have a huge series, and that's obviously huge for England and for him as well, because he's what, going to turn 31 during the series, and is like, you don't, it's obviously lost form a few times, has lost his place and been close to losing his place before. I don't think you get too many more chances. This is kind of a huge summer for him, I think.
I'm not going to be. I'm going to say something which I already slightly regret, but it's my catchphrase, I think. But given how the next 6 months could go, the next 8 months could go, it's not out of the question that England need a new Test captain in January. And the captain of Surrey for the last 5 years, who's probably the most secure batsman in the side, might suddenly look like quite an appealing option. I know there was a bit of murmuring around that a while ago, but
yeah,
I feel like
last
it's
time
gone.
I said that, he then went on a run. You
don't say it, and I'll say it, and I'll take responsibility. But I think that's not out of the question that actually, if he, I personally don't think he'll make any runs in Australia, but if he does well this summer in conditions which are familiar to him, I can see him suddenly that narrative starts to take place, and we all get a little bit excited, because if Root doesn't make runs, you know.
Can I ask another question? How many runless tests do Sibley and Burns need to go through for Hamid to be playing in this series?
Oh, what a question. I think
two, I'm going to say.
So Ben and I were talking about this on the tube here. We're nerds as we talk about this.
Shouting at each other.
So I think with Hamid, it's really interesting. He was in the squad very much as a backup top order batsman.
Sure.
I do think the 100 against India changes things when the man who's currently number three, Zach Crawley, has really struggled in Red Bull cricket, not just for England, but also for Kent in the County Championship. He's got quite a big sample size of first-class cricket, and it doesn't suggest that this is a guy who's going to be a regular run scorer right now in Test cricket. I think his best chance of success is, weirdly, in Australia. I do think if he has a really difficult series, then he becomes unpickable for the Australia series.
Sure.
So I think it's a really big question as to, but change your question slightly, how many tests does Crawley not need to get many runs, where you start for you to then say, let's get Hamid in at three, a position which he has struggled in when he had his really difficult year at Lancashire.
He batted three,
a lot of it, and really, really struggled.
When he knows done.
And he has basically had no success in his career at number three. So then asking someone who's had a really weird, difficult career, he's still only 24, to ask him to bat against that India attack in England at number three, I'm not sure that's that fair either. But then, who the hell else is there if Crawley comes out?
To actually answer Felix's question, how many runless tests? I think Burns, it would be 5-6. I don't think he's not getting dropped. But if Sibley has two ropey tests, just the nature of being an opener against that Indian attack, you can be exposed four times very quickly. And you can be all of a sudden in all sorts. And I think at that point, Hamid becomes a really compelling option, particularly because of the rhythm. I know that Hamid's not as much of a blocker as people made him out to be when he first came through, but like, you bring him through as like a, he's essentially playing the similar role of the guy who's just going to see off the new ball. I think that's probably his route into the side. But yeah, I mean, what we were saying on the tube, the idea that Crawley, part of the reason why he's being given so much rope is because no one else wants to bat three. Literally no one else in England is a number three. Apart from James Bracey, they brought him in and he was seemingly a laughingstock for playing, you know, two tests against the world number one attack, and he struggled. Guess what? He's a good player, but, and I hope he comes back at some point. But I think that's the issue, is that the most obvious route into the side is number three.
Right.
Get Hamid in there. We'd all like to see him. But do you want to be triggering a guy who really struggled in that role and has clearly had quite a roller coaster over the last 2 years?
Yeah, I think one thing with Sibley is that he has less credit in the bank than Burns, but also if he does struggle, he'll kind of look so bad while struggling that people end up drawing sort of conclusions around that. They'll be like, oh, he's never going to score runs with this technique, which is true even when he does score runs, that's what it looks like, but he somehow does. I personally would pick Hamid at three for the first test. I think the Crawley thing, I think this is a symptom actually of the disjointed summer that we've talked about, because at the end of that test series against New Zealand, he was unselectable. Like, his feet were going nowhere. He wasn't playing.
So it's Crawley. Yeah.
He wasn't, is that what I said?
It's not like you two criticise Crawley.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. But like, he was like playing with like absolutely no conviction, and it looked as much meant as it did technical, but neither looked hugely good. And like, all that's happened since then is that time has passed, really. He's got like a few runs in white ball cricket, doesn't have any red ball runs to speak of. Like, there's no reason really to think that like, that those issues have disappeared. Like, all that's like, maybe England will give him one test because like, maybe it is just a bit of time away and some white ball runs that he needed, and they really like him, and I can see why. Maybe that is what they'll do. But I personally, because I think Hamid is more likely to make runs in the first test than Crawley is, so that's why I pick Hamid, basically.
What do you think about Hamid at three, given he's not really batted there, and when he has batted there, he has struggled?
Yeah, I don't think his struggles were because he was batting at three. I think he was just in awful form. I think, and as much as it's difficult, it's tough to ask him to do that, I can see also from like a team balance point of view that that is then a top three, all of whom sort of take their time to get set, and you can easily end up at T, sort of like if like you know,
100 for two
exactly, or if you lose all three just pulled here, you're 100 for three, and all of a sudden you're 185 at the end of the day, and actually you've batted all day, not got many runs, and then you're struggling a little bit. So I can see that argument as well, but I know it's not ideal, and I personally would have had Dawid Malan in this squad just to I know he hasn't played a huge amount of rebel cricket, but I think that again, if you're looking at the guys most likely to make runs in that top order, I think it would have been him, but with the squad they've got, that top three for me is the one that is going to most likely be setting in the platform.
I know exactly what you mean about that kind of one pace top three. That is, it is an issue in some respects, but I also think that everything works a hell of a lot better if Root's making runs and Root's in form, because then suddenly the amplifying effect of that top three, yeah, fine, be 100, whatever, for T. Just make sure you get through, see the first 40 overs off, and then we'll let Root come in against the spinners and dominate. I'm writing something on Root at the moment, probably for you guys. Since the start of 2019 at home, Root averages 31, but specifically averages 12 against good length balls in that time.
That's not very much.
It's not very much. It's not as bad as it sounds, but it's really bad. I think what Root has really struggled with in the last few years is just keeping out good deliveries. If India bowl well, I'm not sure he's good enough in these conditions, in his current iteration with his technique, to keep them out and to dominate. So the best thing you can do is just try and keep him away from the dangerous periods. And I spoke to a few people a while ago about when there was a vacancy in the top order about opening the bat in, whether or not do we push Root back up to the top? That's where he came through. And he said, it was when he was batting four, and they said, well, if I was looking at Jay Root right now, I'd want to move him down, not moving up. And in a functioning England side right now, Joe Root bats number five because that's where he can be busy against the spinners. He's not having to face a swinging ball. He's not having to kind of negotiate those tough periods. So the benefit of having that stodgy top order is that you could get the best out of your now best batsman. And I think that's a reasonable trade-off. I'm happy to see slow, boring cricket for 3 hours if it then means we get to see a good Joe Root for a bit.
So to be clear, you also want Hamid to bat at three in the first test?
Yeah, I should probably say that as well, shouldn't I? Yeah, I think I probably would pick him. Sorry, Rob Key. I would pick him over Crawley.
It would be an amazing story, though, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago.
We just all want it to happen, don't we? It's that thing of just like, we talk about it for long enough and we're like, yeah, we're all going to pick him, aren't we? We all want him.
Yeah, but to be honest, like, I mean, I want Hamid to have a long and fruitful test career, as everyone who has a brain wants. but, like, the main hesitation for me is the effect it could have on him.
Could like, finish him off.
Yeah, possibly. And I mean, Mark Butcher actually said a really good thing on the pod last week, basically saying that, like, look, this is test cricket, it's hard. There's no perfect, easy time to make your test debut, and that's not the point of it. Like, you pick your best team, and then if they can't handle it, that's kind of, that tells you what you need to know, essentially. And I kind of do buy that. But actually, I'm not clamouring for Hamid because I want Hamid to play as soon as possible. Like, in an ideal world, you would be letting him play this summer. I mean, not in the Cannes Championship, but playing whatever's available, and then like letting him get properly back into form and be like have loads of runs under his belt. But needs must, I think.
Making a ton against the Indian attack is probably the best preparation you could have, exactly, given the cricket he's been allowed to play. Yeah.
Series predictions, Felix. Start with you
first. Just suddenly really excited about the whole thing. I haven't thought about it at all until this conversation. I just realised I'm buzzing about it. What do I think is going to happen? I can't predict anything other than England win, can I? Given my relationship with England's greatest ever fast bowler.
5-0 then.
I'm going to say 5-0.
Felix McGrath.
Yeah, exactly.
Ben, I was going 3-2 England before Stokes' injury, but I'm not anymore. I'm not that optimistic.
I'm going to say 3-2 India. Okay. With the caveat that I think if India win the first test, it could go one way quite quickly. But I think England will probably start reasonably well. I think maybe if it's one all after two tests, especially at Lords, India have struggled there recently. I think there's an argument that if England can get on top, then the pressures of touring will take their toll on India. And it's like been a long, horrible tour. And especially by the end of August, yeah, end of September. Christ, it's such a long series. So I think narrow India win, but it could get worse quite quickly.
I would actually expect India to start stronger, given that they've had the Red Bull practice leading into it, whereas the English players have been off playing ODIs and T20s and the 100 and all that. And also, when if Wokes returns from the third test onwards, that is huge for him, because he is like, I mean, maybe without Stokes, he's possibly their best player at home. So if Wokes is back in that side, that could make a big difference. I still think I'll go 2-2, I guess, just to make it.
Where's the draw coming from?
The one thing we'll also say is that I don't think there's been a top six bat in the summer in England that have been so defined, have such responsibilities and roles, like really clear roles as the Indian top six. And I think we haven't seen a test team like that for a very long time, actually, bat in England. So just for that alone, how we deal with them and just seeing them bat every week, I think it's going to be a really beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Because we don't get it often, do we? When teams tour, there's always 3 and 4 not true's batting here. Da, da, da. But they're so set in stone, aren't they? And they're so different in what they add to the side, I think. And they're already just like legends of the game. So I think just them being in front of us every week is just something to really look forward to.
It reminds me a little bit, you're talking about earlier, how grooved they are and how kind of they know all know their roles. And obviously a few injury doubts, but basically they all know what they're going to do. It reminds me a bit of, you know, when Australia had that period where they only ever lost very, very, very occasionally at home, like last 15 years. But actually, if you looked at when the world number one visited Australia, they normally won. So it was like when England went out there in 10-11, when South Africa went out there a few years later, when good sides went to Australia, they won. And whilst we talk about England's record at home, they've not always played... That rarely have sides been arriving at the right time in a cycle. And we've seen that New Zealand arrive at the right time in a cycle and they batter England. You know, if you can batter someone 1-0, but they did. I think India are maybe at that point where like they are just, everyone knows their role. There's the selection debates are the selection debates they have every single time. It's like, do we pick Siraj or Ishan? You know, do we go Jadeja at 7? They know everything about their team. It's just whether or not the individual players can you know, define the legacy by standing up on this occasion, which I think they will. I think they're too good for England.
The one thing that I would say, just from a hope, if you're a hopeful English fan listening to this and getting a bit downbeat, the one thing is that Jasprit Bumrah's form has not been as all-conquering as it was before. He had a back injury at one stage, and he's come back from that and not been quite the same force. Now, you know, that could be temporary. This might be the series that gets him back into it, but that's a little something to cling on to, that maybe there are just like that there are although you can look at the names in that Indian lineup, and you're right, it's almost akin to when it was like a, you know, Sehwag, Dravid, Tendulkar, Lakshman, but there are just slight chinks that you can just cling on to and just hope that it's not going to be an absolute thrashing.
Kohli's not got many in a while. Before we go on the show, a quick word for one of our sponsors, Pants and Socks. Pantsandsocks.com. As I'm sure you can guess, Pantsandsocks.com sells men's underwear. It stocks all the leading designer brands from Calvin Klein to Hugo Boss, from Ralph Lauren to Ted Baker. And more importantly, the site is currently offering 25% off all orders, as well as free delivery on orders over £40. So if you're listening to this wearing saggy, slightly faded underwear, get yourself to pantsandsocks.com and treat yourself to some fresh, well-fitting designer underwear.
Chocolate oranges are available at Rawlinson.
I'm always struck by how well you deliver those adverts, Yaz.
It's because I really believe in them.
Yeah.
It's a real joy to see you in the flesh. Personally, I'm genuinely astonished that we just went from talking about Rishabh Pant and you didn't make a link there. That's damning.
Anyway, the 100 rages on. I'll kind of run through what's happened the last few days since the last show. There was an absolute thriller at Lords last night. Tamal Mills and Chris Jordan clawing Southern Brave back into a game that seemed lost against London Spirit at Lords. Elsewhere in the men's comp, the kids did the business for Birmingham Phoenix against the Trent Rockets. Kiwi Finn Allen blasted a 23-ball 43. And then 19-year-old Somerset batsman Will Smead hit a 13-ball 36. Which is pretty cool. The Oval Invincibles are no longer invincible. They succumbed to a lovely little innings from Harry Brooke, who's enjoying somewhat of a breakout summer in white ball cricket. He's the leading run scorer in the men's competition so far. Joe Clark with the star of the show in Manchester's win over Welsh Fire. And James Vince hit 60 in a tight run chase for the Southern Brave against Birmingham. In the women's comp, Southern Brave are the only side with a 100% record. Amanda Jade Wellington took 4 for 14 against London Spirit in a very straightforward victory at Lords. Heather Graham blasted a quick fire 44 in a win for Trent Rockets over Birmingham. The Superchargers squeezed home by 4 runs against Oval. 16-year-old Alice Capsey took 2 for 9 off of 20 balls to go with a half century early in the competition. And there were half centuries from Hayley Matthews and Danny White in wins for the Welsh Fire and Southern Brave. Ben, your moment of the week is from the 100?
Yeah, it was from Southern Brave's win last night. Or what, I can't remember. Was it last night? Yes, last night, yeah. It's on every day, who knows. But it was from the final knockings of that innings as Southern managed to somehow squeeze it, you know, invoking the spirit of Middlesex for letting spirit collapse around them. But Tamal Mills managing to basically single-handedly win a game, bowling the penultimate over or penultimate set of the game, and then allowing Chris Jordan to come in and take all the glory by defending 11 off the last over. I just think it's exactly what Tamal Mills needs to get into the England World Cup side. I tweeted it at the time, but like Tamal Mills just single-handedly won a game against Owen Morgan in a white ball contest, bowling at the death, improbably securing victory. If he doesn't get in the squad now, he's never going to get in the squad. I just think that the way he's going about his business in this tournament, I'm a big fan of his anyway, and so I probably didn't need much persuading, but he's bowling really quickly and he's nailing his Yorkers, which is a new addition to his armoury. He didn't used to bowl Yorkers. That was his whole thing. Normally just bowled back of a length into the pitch. The fact that he's still doing that, but adding in Yorkers as well, I just think it makes him a really versatile option. You've got, you know, the left armness, the pace, and the fact that he can bowl in different ways, different pitches. You know, I'm no longer scared of him rocking up at Sharjah and just getting absolutely destroyed because people just pick him up over the short boundary. I think he's versatile enough now, and I think a lot depends on his fitness, obviously, because he is fragile. But if they think he's fit enough to go and thus be in a squad and be relied to be part of the group, then I think he plays.
I think it's just interesting that, because obviously that was alongside Chris Jordan, who is the I guess maybe not in a squad but in the 11 the most likely player to miss out. And then if you're missing out of the 11, then you're building a squad, and it's such a small squad, it's a difficult thing to do. And I think that because we all saw in that game Chris Jordan offer, that was a brilliant run out that he did, and I think he brings so much to the just to the group as sort of like a leader in that thing. I mean, I was discussing a piece with Cameron Ponsonby, who's been doing a bit of work with us recently, and we almost wanted to headline it like Chris Jordan Henderson for the impact that Jordan Henderson had for England's like the England squad in the Euro 2020.
Yeah. That's lovely.
Because Chris Jordan couldn't bring that, and that is an important thing in a global tournament. So that is the I do think that if you're picking an 11 based on form, Tamal Mills gets into it, but there are these other considerations,
particularly the context in which this tournament's going to be played. Like, the group environment is massive. I personally would still take Jordan, like, regardless of whether I don't think he's in the first choice 11, but because I think Tamal should be. But Jordan offers so much and covers enough bases as well. And yeah, like I say, he's literally the best T20 fielder in the world by like every metric. Like, why would you, you know, if you can take an expanded squad, you know, there's room for a Jordan.
Felix, we've had quite a few questions about the 100. People are still obviously talking about it, especially on Twitter. Nick Beale asks, just what are your impressions of what's worked well and not worked well in the 100 so far? How have you enjoyed the competition?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm slightly cross-eyed by just all the conversation about whether it's good or bad, to be honest, as we all are. But I was at the first game, the women's game, and I was really struck. I was in the crowd and I was really struck by the fact it was not an atmosphere I'd experienced at cricket before, other than the Women's World Cup final at Lord's, which isn't a coincidence. And I really, in that ground, in that moment, I was really into it. I really understood it. I really felt like it was a really comfortable, lovely atmosphere. And I feel like we are missing that in cricket games, actually, a little bit. And just seeing loads of young girls celebrating and really engaged in the cricket, I was really excited about it. And the next day from home, I watched the men's game. And I felt like it kind of worked. I felt like being slightly semi-mocking about it in the build-up, I thought the way that you read the runs and wickets and stuff like that, I did understand how that can be a little bit more computable. And especially with my girlfriend as well, we're watching some of the women's games at home. It was very interesting to see how she engages with the women's games in a different way than when she's watched all the men's cricket with me, where she just glazes over. She was actually asking, like, oh, what's happening here? And she was sort of getting into the game in a different way. So I think just for that reason alone, I think that's good enough that it's really worked in one sense for 100. Like most short-form cricket, by now I don't know what's going on anymore. I haven't been paying enough attention to, but it's like the same with T20 cricket. Like, apart from a World Cup, I sort of lose track of who's winning and who's losing. And I think everyone's a little bit like that, probably from the outside. I think there isn't that focus on, like, what are the standings in the groups and all that kind of thing.
What does Southern Brave need to do to qualify?
I don't think anyone is, other than like really inside the world, are that fussed about that. But knowing you can turn the TV on and there's cricket there happening, and it's good cricket, because cricket like that always is good. I mean, you can't really argue with it. Even if those were the reasons or not that it was put together in the first place, you can't really argue that it's a cool thing, I think. Mm.
No, 100%. Benz, I wanted to ask you kind of what you thought about some of the law changes we've had for the 100. So in particular, 5 ball overs, 10 balls at one end. What do you think that the impact of those has had, if at all? Do you like them? Would you like to see them in other T20 competitions?
Well, I think from a cricket nerd point of view, I quite like them. In that, this is more something that interests someone who would follow a lot of T20 cricket and be like, and in a way, you almost don't want them to go into lots of other tournaments because you like each one having their own sort of slight differences and that sort of thing. I think what you've seen with, I think it's the 10 ball overs in particular, rather than the reducing to 5, is batsmen getting stranded off strike, and then so you get players like nearly batting through an innings and having not faced very many balls, and then sometimes you get them, like I think Jason Roy innings the other day, I think they might have lost it, but he was able to sort of smash out right at the end, having like struggled up to that point, and that is interesting and fun to watch. And I think you just like differences, basically, because as Felix says, these things can all just sort of meld into one. So if you can get something that makes it a little bit more different, then that's good. I mean, the one, it's not a rule change from the Blast, but it's different to other T20 leagues around the world, is the fielder having to come in when there's when they don't make the over 8, which I think is a, I don't know if they call it over 8, they don't make the time cut off, and that, I mean, it's interesting, it's good because it makes teams rush around, but it's also just really interesting when it happens, and you can get like huge swings to a batting side at that point, and that's just great and interesting to watch as well. I don't know if these things are exactly keeping people bringing new people in, but I also don't think that everything about it needs to do that. I think that like the 10 ball overs brings new people in because it makes it a bit quicker, and as does the time cutoff rule. And then if it also happens to appeal to sort of the T20 purists, if you like, then that's a good thing too, I guess.
Because on that point quickly, it's interesting how it has infiltrated my head, because I played a game of cricket yesterday, like club cricket, 30 overs. I'm really low level. Some people can't play at all. Some people are proper. And we're fielding for like what felt like 6 hours, like running from point to point type thing. And I did halfway through, I did think to myself, this would be a lot better actually if we weren't doing this every 30 seconds. And I would have hated myself having that thought before this came across. But I was actually thinking that this would just be a much more manageable social situation if we were just doing 10 there I sort of hate myself for saying that, but it did just pop into my head for a second. So it'll be interesting to see how it filters down, like if at club cricket people start actually playing it and just realise it kind of works in an easy, you know what I mean? A more
manageable way. When you play last man stands, that's 100 balls, and that's kind of similar. It's not quite the same, but you don't play all the same rules, and obviously it's quicker because it's shorter. I think one thing that you could do to kind of go against what I normally say, if you wanted to just tweak the blast and you wanted to go that, is you could just make them bowl 10 overs from one end and 10 overs from the other. And that would have the same effect in terms of quicking the game up. To be honest, I don't think you really need to quick the blast up. It's already really quick because of the cutoff rule. I think that's, you know, there's lots of different ways around that. Basically, just reducing the number of times where people have to run from one end of the ground to the other. That's obviously just a practical thing, which makes sense. What I do really like about the 5-ball overs and the 10-ball overs, and I think it's something which I wouldn't be surprised if other leagues did adopt, is one bowler bowling two overs consecutively, whether it's 5 balls or 6 balls or whatever, but the opportunity to for the captain to almost stick or twist. I think that's a really nice little dramatic moment that happens every single stage of the innings. You get 20 of those moments in innings where it's like, okay, does Owen Morgan, you know, or does Lewis Gregory bowl Rashid Khan out now, or does he? And actually, the opportunity for him to just really double down and increase the pressure. I think that's massive. I think that's been really exciting.
Dan, that made me think of let me think about baseball, where you want to get a reliever pitcher on, and you've got to work out, is he too tired, or do we go one more with him? And that's a really, really huge facet of baseball that actually makes it really interesting.
And actually, it's a good example, because people often use baseball as the example of why T20 cricket is rubbish. They're just whacking it. It's like rounders. But actually, these sports are nuanced as well. So just because it's shorter format and there's more sixes, you still need to pay attention. What I really liked as well is that I've gone through the numbers a little bit, and there's no consistent pattern yet as to if you bowl another 5, the bowler dominates, or you bowl another 5, the batsman dominates, or the batter dominates. There is no kind of clear advantage that's come through yet, which is good. Because if it had gone in one way, they would have been this rule is skewing things too far the other way, which I know Yaz is about to say.
That's interesting that numbers say that. I've felt watching it. So I really like the new rules from kind of piquing my interest. I've enjoyed kind of wondering how different captains are going to negotiate the new rules. But one thing just from the marketability of the tournament, I kind of thought that 5-ball overs and 10 balls at each end slightly tipped things in the favour of a bowler, in that I don't know if the numbers back this up. I almost feel that the 6th ball of an over is the most likely to go for 6 in a T20 game. And that if you have a spinner bowling 10 balls against a couple of batsmen who aren't great against spinners, for example, that can change things. The thing about batsmen being stranded on strike, Crawley basically carried his bat and only faced 40 out of 100 balls last weekend. So I think basically is that for a new tournament, you want it to be as run friendly as possible. I just think that new fans are going to enjoy 180 versus 180 more than 140 against 140. But from an actual cricketing point of view, I think it's been fine and actually been something that gives regular cricket fans something new to be interested in. I just wonder what new cricket fans will be thinking.
Do you guys just interested to see how you feel, because obviously everyone's got their stance and publicly saying things, but do you feel people that actually inside cricket watch every day, are people feeling it kind of works, or is it still completely split? And
I think there's the divisions are still there,
right?
I think partly it's because a lot of the journalists and media people who are extremely against it have essentially taken the week off, or taken a couple of weeks off, because they're almost protesting it. So I think the anti-coverage has naturally fallen away a little bit. And I don't think that's necessarily because the feeling's fallen away. I think it's just because practically these people aren't on the desk. But I also think that it's obviously just so much easier to get people on board with really good cricket matches than it is with the idea of really good cricket matches.
Sure.
We're like, oh yeah, it's going to be really good. Sunil Narine's going to be bowling to such and such, and it's going to be amazing. And there's going to be full crowds, and it's going to be, you know, mums and kids, and it's going to be really fun and a different vibe and a different feel. Tell people that, and they're like, yeah, well, maybe come back in a year. Suddenly, when it's actually happening, I think the people who are on the fence, or people who just aren't even on the spectrum of the debate, just slightly removed from it, like yourself to an extent.
Yeah,
it's like, yeah, I can go with this a lot more easily than just having to pick a side and pick a tribe and be like, I'm pro 100, I'm anti 100. It's like, I'm pro cricket. I just like watching cricket on a Friday night. And it doesn't matter what the format is.
Yeah, I'd also say that most of the people who are against the competition still thought the cricket would be great. They still thought that people would watch it. I think it's more about, I know there's some
I disagree.
There are some people who I think it's a minority that actually thought the cricket was going to be bad and the tournament was actually bad. I think it's more about the impact having a different 8-team-based competition in the middle of the summer, what that has on the county championship, the county structure, the test team, etc.
Got you.
And none of that's changed. So.
Yeah, and that, none of that's changed. And to be honest, you
really
won't see the...
really bad, they
exactly,
won't change
exactly.
Opinion on that.
And you won't really see the long-term effects of this. I mean, the long-term effects, I don't think you'll see the effects of this. Possibly for quite a long time, I think.
Got you.
I would just say one thing about the... what you were saying about low-scoring games versus high-scoring games. I think the thing that makes a cricket tournament succeed is that the games are good, basically. And the games have been good so far. And I think sometimes you can take a bit of... You can accept a bit of extra complication, like in the Big Bash with the power surge rule, or... like if it brings like an extra benefit, basically. So people talking about like the 10 balls at one end, that is an extra complication, but it brings extra benefit in that it makes the games a bit quicker. Bowling 10 balls in a row is a bit of an extra complication, but if it creates moments of drama and moments of tension, I think that's a good thing. And I think that is, I mean, that it's one of those things that you can only see, and you probably, because you might have just been lucky so far to get as many close games as there's been, but I think we're going to see at the end of the tournament, if there have been like as many close finishes, or they keep having the same ratio as they do now, I think then that has to be seen as a success of the rules that they've chosen, I guess.
One last thing, because Yaz is going purple in the face. One thing I really was pro about before the tournament, and it's something I think about with all these leagues, whether it's the IPL, the CPL, whatever. One of the things that is fundamentally really good about them is the idea of scarcity, the idea that there's one game a day or two games a day, and you can watch every game, and you can't do that with a Blast. And Ben's written very eloquently in the past about the idea of like like Gillette Soccer Saturday, but for the Blast, and the idea of that's trying to add some narrative to a tournament where you've got constant games. But I think that we've seen these examples of like players who just would have gone under the radar. Like Harry Brook is not an incredible example because he's obviously going to be a star and everyone knew he was going to be a star because of the way he's played in age group cricket. But suddenly everyone's watched Harry Brook bat 3 or 4 times on live TV. They've seen him whack a stick. It's not on a live stream. It's not on a fixed camera. It's with the commentators. It's with Kevin Peterson. It's with Michael Atherton commentating over him. I think that's not necessarily part of that's not necessarily a pro of the 100 per se, but these tournaments more generally, they create these moments. And I said, when we spoke before the series, before the tournament, you asked me what would constitute success. And I said, if you have 5 or 6 moments across the series, across the summer, which are like proper water cooler moments. And we've had a couple already. We've had Brooke destroying him up at Headingley. We've had,
Benjamin.
Benjamin, like on within the first couple of
Capsy.
Days, Capsy is a great example. Rodrigues, we've also had the Hales versus Stokes thing. That was such that game could have happened in the Blast, no question. You know, pretty good at T20 cricket, but it didn't happen as the only game that was on a Monday night where everyone's tuning in. You don't get those narratives circling. I think for that exact reason, I think it's already a tick in the box. There are flaws, and as you say, those flaws aren't going away. But I think it's delivered on what it promised to, probably in a positive and negative sense.
Mm. I'm just going to run through the other news from the World Game in the last week before we get to Felix's book. Australia and Bangladesh are set to meet for the first time in a bilateral T20 series tomorrow, with their 4 previous matches have only ever been in T20 World Cups. In the Royal London One Day Cup, Nick Gubbin scored 131 and then took 4 for 38 with his part-time leg spin, having only ever taken 1 professional wicket before for Hampshire against Sussex. Ben, what's your moment of the week?
My moment of the week, it was a weird moment because with press releases from Sri Lanka, they always take like kind of a while to sort of come into your inbox. Often they go into your spam and you see like someone tweet, but sometimes it's like you're trying to work out if it's like generally true or not, and there's a lot of reports that circle like this kind of thing. So I sort of saw some tweets and was like, no, that can't be true, and then went and like looked through my spam folder and was like, saw the research, oh, that is true. So the 3 cricketers who sort of broke the biosecure protocols, that's Dhanushka, Gunatilaka, Nirushan Dikwela and Kusal Mendis, on their tour of England, have been banned for a year from playing in Test cricket, and with another year suspended. Which is, I mean, when you consider...
It's a bit harsh, isn't it?
I mean, when you consider the sort of the furore and the uproar and the outrage that was at Jofra Archer sort of going home for 20 minutes during the test last time, and he missed a test match, and that was the outcome of that. To miss a whole year, that is absolutely enormous. That's like...
What, is it all cricket?
They've been banned from domestic cricket for 6 months and from international cricket for a year. Yeah, it's
almost the definition of draconian, isn't it?
It's just like, And
it's just a bit harsh, isn't it?
It is a bit harsh. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, and I mean that, you know, there are going to be two World Cups in that time, or at least one. It's not good for Sri Lanka's chances as well when they kind of need all the players they can get. I mean, because I was talking to someone who had a Sri Lankan overseas pro at their club this summer, and they were sort of like saying, like, you must be pretty close just getting an emergency call up at this point.
Anyway, moving on. Felix, you have a book out this week.
I do, which you suggested should be my moment of the week, but then I thought that might be deeply egotistical for my book.
And yet, here we are.
And here we are.
Yeah, here we are. But I might just make clear that it's not my moment
okay.
of the week.
Okay, I've not said mine, so it can be my moment of the week.
Okay, thank you, mate.
So the tagline is A Matter of Life in Cricket. When you started writing it, what did you try and set out to do?
When I started writing this, a couple of years ago. And the idea to begin with was, as tailenders has sort of ended up becoming, by the way, I'm very taken back to be on a cricket podcast that's actually about cricket, because ours is definitely not anymore, but it ended up, tailenders ended up being like, all roads started to lead back to me being like, this is how it feels, how cricket feeds into your life. And this is how it feels, and this is how it runs alongside mine. So the idea of the book really, at first, was that I kind of imagined it as like High Fidelity, but using cricket as the thing rather than records. So I would sort of stop off in a memoir style, and at each moment where cricket had foreboded something about my life or articulated something, I'd explain it and then meet the cricketer involved. And then their recollection sort of spins the story out whichever way it goes. So the cricketers involved have been Phil Tufnell, trying to get Alan Wells for when he walks off during his only test match and says sorry into the lens of the camera, and I feel like as a 12-year-old kid he said sorry to me. So we go over that, and he says yeah, that I was saying sorry, it's not to you but to my children, and that kind of thing. Who else is it? Chris Lewis, Adam Holyoake, Atherton Hussain, Kumar Sangakkara, Joss Butler's in it, Simon Kerrigan about his test, loads of cricket. I've missed some as well, but so basically I'm stopping at each moment and sort of using it as a parallel to whatever's going on in my life at that time. So it started that way. And then as I got into it, basically, I just realized, as probably most people do when they start writing memoir style things, but it couldn't be completely flippant, and I had to go properly in. So it ended up becoming basically about my mum's illness and death when I was 17, and how I found ways to process the loss and then the repressed grief since. And so a lot of it was about why do we put love into the places we do? And it kind of led back to the fact that I think it was very fortunate for me growing up in the 90s, but England lost all the time. And so for a lot of men at that age to watch these alpha males processing their own loss constantly, I found some sort of comfort and familiarity in it. And then obviously as things change, my life slightly changes. And then when England win the Ashes in Australia, eventually I remember feeling completely sickened by it and really angry, because I felt like we had a deal where England lost. I felt communal hurt in it. So I had like loads of inexplicable feelings at the time of like being like, no, that's not a deal we have. And being angry at people that were celebrating it. So anyway, it's just sort of an unpacking of that entire thing, yeah. Really, yeah.
How did you find the writing process? Because it sounds like you've gone on a bit of a journey of self-exploration.
I don't know, if Ben will say the writing process, I found it most of the time horrible. Like I was kind of, because you're just on your own writing it. And I kidded myself that I was writing it just to myself. I was pretending to myself that no one's going to read this. So there's loads of very personal stuff in here, which now I feel even as I'm talking to you, I want to run to that warehouse and burn all the books that are going to get sent to people next week, because I've put almost everything in my life into it. But how do I feel about it? I feel the same way about as cricket. I don't enjoy playing cricket, but I enjoy having played cricket. And I think I probably feel the same about this book. I didn't necessarily enjoy all the writing of it, but in time, I think I'll feel good that I have written it.
There's a beautiful section about in the book about the Maccabees' last gig that's almost worth buying just for that section alone. And you spent years in a very successful band, and now you work in cricket. So you've managed to work in two of your real passions. How did the pivot to cricket come around?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I've always really loved cricket. So cricket, as probably everyone listening to this podcast will know, is always on in some form in your life. It's always in the background. You're always sort of feeding into it in some way. So I've always really loved cricket. But interestingly, actually, when the Maccabees were getting to their, like, you know, whatever, we're getting more and more popular, a woman that worked at the label said, we need to find more ways to, like, PR your interests. So she's like, what do you like? I was like, I like cricket. And anyway, she, like, basically, over a three-week period, when I was very reluctant at first, said, you should do some cricket stuff. And eventually, Phil Walker from Wisden came down to the studio, and he did a piece about me loving cricket. And I think he was on, I don't think he had any questions prepared, but on the flyer, he was like, what's your ultimate cricket 11, but they're all musicians. So I'd like Kraftwerk opening the batting, and I can't remember, it was a bit of nonsense. But anyway, like that was really fun. And then Phil said to me, you should write about cricket, man. Like, you should do that. And I'd never really thought about it, but I started writing from hotel rooms on tour or whatever. Just Phil would ask me to write something for what was All Out Cricket at that time. And I just write little bits, and like, it just felt like a natural thing to do and fine. And then, yeah, I do have a lot to owe Phil, because he was always saying, like, you got to quit this music business, man. You got to get into cricket writing. And but I didn't actually think that was actually going to happen. And I'm not a cricket writer, really. But yeah, that's how it kind of seeded. And then when the band did break up, I wrote a huge piece for What Was All Out of Cricket about what happens when cricket is retired, because my first thought had been meeting Kyle Hogg when he had just retired, having been player of the year for Lancashire when they won the county championship. And he was becoming a music rep. And so he'd come into the Maccabees dressing room loading beers into the fridge. And I was like, he was so familiar to me. I was like, sorry, mate, are you Kyle Hogg? And, and he's like, yeah, we had this chat, and his career...
I get that all the time.
Yeah, and his career... Yeah, exactly. His career had ended, and he was entering his new life. So I thought about him when my band finished, and I wrote this piece in conversation with loads of cricketers. And then from there, I don't know, I just sort of... Greg called me up and said, should we do a podcast with Jimmy? And I was like, that sounds fun. And then we're here like 3 or 4 years later, I guess.
That literally is as simple as that.
It kind of was, yeah.
I remember reading that piece, and I'm thinking, this is really good. And I basically had exactly the same kind of relationship with it. I started reading, I was like, oh, this is Felix. It can't be that Felix, because I was a Maccabees ultra as a teenager.
And
I was just reading, and I was like, yeah, okay, well, that hangs together. I was like, he's suddenly infringing on my other interests now. It's like he's kind of been coming in. But like, the tail end of stuff is so cool, because it has such a fan base, and like such a warmth from the people who love it. And like, if I ever chat to people who like cricket, or like someone will say, oh, you know, this is Benny, works in cricket, and I'll start, you know, name dropping, trying to impress them, saying the people that I've met, and I'll be like, yeah, I met Shane Warne, and they're like, you know, oh yeah, cool, I'm Michael Atherton, and then I'll be like, oh yeah, met Felix a few times, oh what, from Tailenders, yeah. And suddenly it's like I've got them in the palm of my hand, because I think for people who, as you say, have that relationship with cricket all the time, and it's not necessarily that they're like in the ins and outs of like every single game, every being played, but like it's part of them. I think Tailenders is like a real way in for that kind of relationship with the game. And I mean, I don't know, it's something to do with the warmth of it. I know we're not talking about Tailenders, talking about the book, but like, I think it all plays into that idea of cricket. It's not a separate thing. It's part of your life. It's kind of built into the way you process and
exactly
feel,
that. That's completely right. That's really nice of you to say, Ben. That's exactly that. And I think that's what most cricket lovers know, that feeling of like, and Jimmy talks about it on the podcast, where he'll walk over a crack in the pavement and his foot will be over the line, he'll go, that's a no ball. Or like all that kind of thing. Or like, I'll have walking across the road, if a bus goes past me really fast, I'll sort of in my head for a second, I'll be dodging out of the way, like I've just nudged out, got out of the way of a fast ball and get ready again. And it's that kind of thing, how cricket just runs through everything. So Tailenders has become a sort of, I think it's credit to Jimmy really, because he's been willing to discuss all that stuff really openly and in an unguarded way. And so it's been a channel through, but everyone will be like, oh, I do exactly what Jimmy Anderson does, you know, and that's quite a nice sort of link between the two things, I think. Yeah,
yeah, my weird cricket thing is whenever a bus goes past and I've got a request, when I ask the bus to stop, I always say no ball.
What? Oh, what, when you put your arm out?
I put my arm out, like, yeah, no ball.
do you do this one as well? And it's all very crossing the road, but I cross the road, and if there's a car, I go, wait there, no. Yeah. In my head, as a car's coming, and then run.
My one is always that if I shadow bowl a ball and I think it's not quite right, I have to bowl it again. So like if I think it's drifting down the leg, I'm like, oh, no, I'm going to have to re-bowl that anyway.
Yeah.
So.
I think Yaz has a really niche favourite shadow batting shot, which I think is like avoiding a rising sort of good length delivery.
I love that.
And dropping it's too good for you.
Get your head out of the way.
Well bowled.
Little nod.
Little nod. I love the nod.
Just on Telenders again. Why do you think it's become the phenomenon it is? Because there isn't really another phenomenon like it in English cricket.
To be honest, when we first started doing Telenders, I was amazed when they went out. I thought that the bits that weren't the podcast were the stuff we were recording beforehand. I didn't realise we were actually going to use like the chat. So it's, and I think that's part something in that. It's like it was so sort of casual in a way, and just like even I didn't realize what we were talking about. And it's got like, it's taken us down some really, I think I've had to learn to not take, not that I think I took myself too seriously before, but the spicy incidents with Michael Vaughan was genuinely horrific at the time, which I don't know if the listeners of this will know that, what all that stuff that happened.
Anyone who's been on Twitter will know.
Will know that, yeah. So I definitely had some like very weird vortexes, very surreal, psychedelic things where I'm inside the cricket world, but not in the way that I wanted to be at all. But it's just kind of become part of the fun of it. And we just sort of learned to sort of stitch it into the show, really. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, the book is out this week.
Yeah, it's out. It's my moment of the week. Oh, it's your moment of the week. It's out this week.
It's
out the 5th of August, which is the same day that Greg's released the vegan sausage, cheese and bean melt, which is a big moment if you're a vegan. So massive, I'm going to be eating that and getting grease all over. This is new book, I think.
You can pre-order the book now at wisdom.com/shop.
Sorry. I completely misunderstood that. I was like, Greg James is releasing a vegan.
I thought that as well. Anyway, that is all we've got time for on today's show. Ben, thank you very much. Felix, great having you on.
Pleasure.
Ben, great having you on as always. This is the Wisdom Cricket Weekly Podcast. If you enjoy the show, tell your friends, and we'll be back next week. Cheers.
Podcast Network.